Last month, Mark Isham was awarded the Composer of the Year honor at the annual Hollywood Film Festival. The award was well-deserved, if only for the astounding fact that Isham's creative output for 2007 includes unforgettable scores for a whopping 7 feature films, including Freedom Riders, Gracie, Next, Lions for Lambs, and the Valley of Ella, Reservation Road, Frank Darabont's upcoming film The Mist, and that's not even counting his work for the entire first season of Paul Haggis's The Black Donnellys television series. In fact, upon review of Mr. Isham's remarkable resume, it's hard not to categorize him as the composer of the past quarter century, having meticulously crafted a series of extraordinary scores for films as diverse as The Hitcher, Romeo is Bleeding, Blade, Night Falls in Manhattan, Quiz Show, Rules of Engagement, Crash, The Black Dahlia, In Her Shoes, and A River Runs Through It, for which he earned an Academy Award nomination. It is a tremendous honor for all of us here at Movie Geeks United to welcome to the show Mr. Mark Isham. Mr. Isham, are you with us?
I am. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you very much for being with us. It's a great treat to speak with you tonight.
Oh, well, likewise. A great treat to be here.
How about this career you've... I mean, no doubt you've had an exceptional career, but...
It's been going
year,
pretty well, yeah.
Yeah, this year seems to just be crazy for you. Your 7 projects and...
This last year has been a pretty exceptional year, and especially the quality and the new relationships, old relationships have come around to be, Paul Haggis making a new film, Robert Redford making a film. I mean, these are pretty extraordinary opportunities for me. I'm just glad to be here and have the opportunity to join them.
Yeah, and you've worked with both several times, and talk about great collaborators to have on your side. I mean, that's as good as it gets.
Well, it is. I mean, I was been thinking about that recently, that really one of the great joys of this profession is that collaboration. I mean, filmmaking, I think, is the true collaborative art form, and but it always needs a great captain, to captain that ship. And
yeah,
I've been very, very fortunate in my career to work with some of the best. I mean, you mentioned Brian De Palma. I mean, I did The Black Dahlia for him a year ago, and it's going well.
Well, I would definitely want to ask you about all of these high-profile collaborations and your process, but tell us a little bit about how your musical education began.
Well, I was very fortunate. I was born into a family that was very musical. My mother is still a professional violinist up in the San Francisco Bay Area, and my father is a professor of history and the humanities. So I was a lot of music around the house. And at a young age, my mother would drag me into a lot of orchestra rehearsals, and I discovered the trumpet. I thought it was the coolest instrument in the orchestra, loud, bold, I thought that was for me, so I became a trumpet player and worked professionally, and of course still have a trumpet playing career that I managed to hold on to. If the film work does lets up occasionally, and I just loved music, all sorts of genres. I have a background in classical music, but I discovered jazz at a very early age, and I also discovered electronic music actually at a very early age, and sort of those three elements, I just continued to sort of bounce around and explore through my 20s. It included, of course, playing in more pop rock bands just to make a living.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time I reached my late 20s, early 30s, I had probably, a pretty impressive education in music, more or less just by doing it and being involved in it.
Right.
And at that time, the timing was really good because a film director, Mr. Carroll Ballard, heard a piece of music that I had written and said, that's what I've been looking for. I didn't know how to describe it, but that's it. That's what this film needs. And he tracked me down and offered me the opportunity to score Never Cry Wolf.
Never Cry Wolf, exactly, yeah.
And, I had no training in film music whatsoever, but I realized this was a tremendous opportunity, and I should grab it, and I should do everything I possibly can to complete it.
So had you given any thought previous to that about film composing?
Not really. I think at one time, I think a dance company had approached me, and I'd written one piece for a dance company. And so I knew that there was professions out there that, that one could do that, where you wrote music to accompany image. And obviously I went to movies, and I knew that I was a fan of Henry Mancini and and John Williams, and I knew the big names, but for some reason it's never been a career choice for me until it was sort of thrust at me.
Yeah.
And then I just said, well, why not? Let me just try it. And it was a remarkable experience. I found that, I think just to find that somebody wants you to compose instrumental music and wants to pay to have it recorded well was such a, such a unique experience. You know, that I said, well, this is quite something. Maybe I should look into this. And,
yeah.
And the rest sort of was history.
Well, the process just fascinates me. And I want you to take me through the process of, as best you can, of scoring a picture. And let's take, if you don't mind, Lions for Lambs, which I've had on repeat. I said at the beginning of the show, I'm going to wear the CD out because I'm in love with the score. So you sit down and you watch the picture and you get first impressions. Tell me what starts to come together for you when you try to find a musical voice for that film.
Well, Lions for Lambs, it was quite interesting. I met with Bob and actually went to the set when he was still shooting the last parts of the movie. And so I had a chance to get a sense of what he was doing there and met with him for a couple of hours afterwards and heard, you know, what he was looking for. And the meeting must have gone well and reaffirmed that... you know, that we worked well together because he hired me immediately after that. And then he said, look, let me get some rough assembly done and then we should talk further.
Right.
And I went up to his place in Northern California about a month or so later, and he had about 5 scenes assembled. And he said, look, we put some music in here and I think you should hear it because it's not what I was expecting. And he was right, because it was not what I was expecting either. I thought when I read the script that this would be not too dissimilar to Valley of Ella or Crash. You know, it was intimate piece. There were no more than 2 or 3 people in a room at the same time. Even the more action-oriented stuff is just 2 guys and they're stuck. They're not moving. Nothing. You know, not a lot of things are happening viscerally in the script. And yet somehow the way that Joe Hutching was cutting it together, it had tremendous momentum.
Mm-hmm.
And they had put some very, very rhythmic music in the front of the picture, and I just looked at Bob and said, you know, all my intellectual instincts would have said that would be wrong, but it's great. It's just great. It does a lot for this movie. And we both agreed right from there that the score was going to be bigger and more just different, you know, very different than any sort of initial analysis from the script would yield you to believe.
Yeah. It seems to be very similar to Crash in the movie itself, in that it's a movie of ideas and these kind of interweaving stories.
Well, exactly, and the score for Crash is quite delicate.
Yeah,
and sort of floats above the movie.
Yeah,
and which was perfect for that movie, and one which, you know, we came to with a little experimentation, and it became very clear to Paul and I after not much experimentation that was really the most effective way to do it. This film is the exact opposite. I mean, we charge into this thing as if it's a Tony Scott thriller.
Exactly, yeah.
And it works. And then I must say the score just does change gears. But what's interesting about the structure of this score is that it changes gears gradually. After the first reel and a half, those harder-edged electronic sounds start to gradually, you know, every cue they're a little less.
Mm.
And every cue, the orchestra starts to take more of a major role.
Mm-hmm.
So that by the time you get to the last reel and a half, the orchestra has really stepped up, and you really feel a large, organic, very emotional presence, emotional in a very traditional way. And by the last, you know, the penultimate scene, electronics, for all intents and purposes, faded out. The full orchestra has stepped forth. There's a woman's choir has arrived, and we have a very, you know, intensely emotional ending. It done in the sense of using a large orchestra for that in a traditional way, although the music itself, I think, is definitely not traditional.
Thank you.
Now, you mentioned that they used a temp score. How do you, what's your perspective on the use of temp scores? Is it helpful? Do you kind of resent it because you can't start with a blank slate? Or?
I don't resent it. I find more often than not that they do have some help, even for me. Occasionally they can become problematic, and because I've been doing this for a little while now, I've sort of got some tricks up my sleeve of how to solve the problems of temp love, for instance. You know,
right.
A director or filmmaking team who've just fallen in love with an earlier piece of music and can't get it out of their mind that this is the only way to do it. So barring you know, things like that, it's actually quite helpful because it is very difficult to verbalize music.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that you know, all the talking in the world sometimes can't really explain the sensation that you're getting from a particular piece of music in a particular place that you couldn't begin to explain to somebody how, you know, what that is. And it's just much easier to play. You see the interaction here, and then I can analyze that and figure out, well, what are the elements that are creating this effect, and then I can ditch the specifics and use the general ideas, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Having said that, there is something wonderful about diving into a picture which you've never seen any music except something that you create for it originally. But once again, I think I've out of experience, I can sort of recreate that for myself. I can take a day off from writing, and then I come back and just look at the picture with no music and pretty much sort of mock up that effect again for myself if I want to do that.
Yeah. Well, you currently have two other projects that are in theaters and in stores as well, and that's in the Valley of Ella and Reservation Road. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, when you're composing these pictures, I mean, I'm sure that you almost have to find yourself living in the picture in a sense.
It's very true, and that's an interesting way of describing it. I think that's pretty spot on. I was trying to describe it the other day, actually, and described it similarly in that you want to get into that universe. You know, the,
mm-hmm.
a good filmmaker creates a very specific universe that story is unfolding in, and that's why it's very important for me to start writing once I have a picture. I find it very difficult to write from just a script.
Yeah,
I like to see the fabric of this universe, the colors of it, you know, the size of it. Is it shot so that everything seems very constricted and tight and small and introverted? Or is it shot so it's wide open and things seem limitless? I mean, those are very important sensations to take into account for music. I mean, space is a big element that music can contribute to,
mm-hmm.
and needs to be a part of in a correct balance. So, yeah, it's that image. And as you say, it's living that life that the story is telling, being in that universe. I throw myself into it, and once the musical universe is defined, then it starts to flow, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Then I can write, you know, sad music or happy music or reconciliatory music or whatever it needs to be in that vocabulary of that universe.
Yeah. Do you find too that the best directors are the ones with the strongest musical sense?
It doesn't have to be specifically musical sense, but it has to be a real sense of emotion and how it works, and
mm-hmm.
and not a contrived sense of how it works, but a real ability to have looked at life and see how it really works, you know. And one of the great things about working with Bob Redford is that he is such a fine actor, and he really can look at a character and a character's experience in a storytelling and describe that arc as to what's happened, you know, what's happened before, what's happening precisely at these moments, and where are we headed, and where's that character, you know, the evolution, emotional evolution of this character. And I find someone who can articulate those things well and pinpoint, you know, the points in a story that connect and the way that the emotions transfer from one character to another, or one scene to another, and all these fine points of a story, if they can just communicate that to me, I can translate it into music.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, sometimes it's better that they don't try and do it, that they just leave that to me. And So I find, and Haggis is the same way. He's such a great writer that he can look at and feel, you know, and be very precise. You know, at this moment, Mark, even though, you know, things are exploding, what's happening in this person's head is this, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the music, I want the music inside their head, so I need you to do this. And insight into it like that is what's really the most valuable.
Mm. I was going to ask you about Redford and Haggis, and you've already spoken to them, but let me ask you about a couple of the other collaborators, directors that you've worked with. I know Frank Darabont, you've composed for him a couple of times, and the latest is with The Mist.
Yeah.
And what a treat was that to score essentially a great monster movie.
Well, it is, you know, and it's really a first time that I've done a real, just no-holds-barred monster movie.
Yeah.
And Frank, you know, is very upfront about that in talking about the film himself. He says, you know, this it's a low-budget horror film, kids, and we're having the time of our life. Of course, the truth of the matter is that, you know, Frank is just one of the all-time great writers and directors, and in his hands, you know, a very simple horror story, although, you know, masterfully told, of course, by one of the great master horror storytellers.
Right.
But turned into a film, again, by a real master, it rises way above that genre and becomes really quite something extraordinary. And, I mean, Frank is again, one of very, very similar in that way that he loves music, he respects music tremendously. He'll leave the translation to me. And
mm-hmm.
But he is so tuned into his storytelling and so tuned into exactly where things change and how characters, you know, their internal struggles versus their external struggles and how all of this ties together and where things, you know, should bend and twist and that, you know, he's a great navigator through those things and can point out all the spots that need to be pointed out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you can definitely see that in his work, what a master storyteller he is.
Oh, just one of the finest.
Yeah, and of course, we mentioned it a little earlier, but I have to ask you about your experience with De Palma on The Black Dahlia, because you talk about just a visual artist. I mean, his films are just visual feasts that must be incredible to compose to those.
Yes, yeah. I mean, working with De Palma was really tremendous because he's actually quite very different from, you know, some of these other directors. He is, in a sense, very, well, you see it in his filmmaking style. He's very sort of black and white. You know, things are big, gestures are big. It's like, bam, bam. Okay, now we're here. No, now we're here. And now we're doing this, and now we're doing this. And then just when you thought we were going to do this, no, we're going to do the exact opposite. And therefore, it's sort of liberating score-wise because you can follow him in those big gestures.
Yeah.
And, you know, things that I would never do in a Paul Haggis or a Terry George movie, you know, you can just do with wild abandon in a Brian De Palma movie. And in fact, you know, I had to push myself to be bigger and bolder and even more extravagant. But then also the level of detail that he has in his image. I found that orchestrationally was really inspired me, I really wanted to find an orchestral vocabulary that was unique and very, how should I say this, emotionally raw, but at the same time very sophisticated in its structure. And so there was a lot of Leonard Bernstein influence, and just, I had a blast on that score.
Well, you get to, it utilizes the trumpet.
Well, yes, I hired somebody I know pretty well to play the trumpet, and convinced him he had to practice.
it reminded me, not that the score sounds like it, but because of the time period of the film and the use of the trumpet, I thought back on Chinatown. The
crew. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I thought about that myself and said, well, what the hell, I'm going to break it.
Thank you. So tell me how the computer has changed what you do, that technology.
Well, it makes a certain part of the score writing process quicker. Certainly access to a wide variety of sounds when you're demoing for yourself and then demoing for the filmmakers. You know, you have basically at your fingertips, if you go spend a couple of days designing things and organizing things well, pretty much anything you can imagine, which, of course, is very different than 10, 15 years ago when it would take, you know, days to put together a studio that could create demos of that sophistication.
Yeah.
Which, of course, is a tremendous boon, and it really helps the demo process. It really helps inspiring confidence in the filmmakers that you're on the right track. They can hear, with very little exception, I think, almost a fully realized mock-up of a score that doesn't leave a lot to the imagination. And this, of course, is very good for nervous filmmakers and nervous producers and nervous studios, and especially if you're spending a lot of their money. They're very happy about that, and I'm happy too, because then the recording sessions are much more relaxed.
Yeah.
So I think in general the process is and the technology that we have is good for the process. The one thing that I have to constantly remind myself, though, is to not get lulled into that the instruments that you're writing for are so much more capable than the fake versions that I have in the studio.
Right.
And not to forget that the orchestra is capable of a lot more, and to know that there's a part two to the writing, that I can write something, present it as a demo, know that they love it, but know that after that then that I really have to push myself and the orchestrators to let the final score rise as high above that as possible and not just get sort of stuck in the electronic world.
Yeah. I had a question for you that I always tend to ask one question that's just off the wall and embarrasses me, but this might be one of them. I've heard actors say that when they read a scene, there's often an obvious way to play the scene, but when they try to play it the exact opposite way, it kind of makes it more interesting and it kind of brings out a deeper truth to the moment. As a composer, are you looking for ways to avoid the obvious musical cliches and can you give me an example of an instance where you did this, kind of created a musical counterpoint, I guess you'd say?
The basic answer to that question is yes. I mean, I am always looking for a different way of doing it. I'm trying to think of some. I mean, obviously, I remember there was one point I don't remember the film, but. And this has been a way that other directors have done it the not obvious way too. But you know, like a heavy war scene, for instance, all of a sudden the battle sounds and the heavy action music fade out, and you might just have a choir singing a very simple hymn, right? Things like that can be incredibly powerful. I remember Oliver Stone, I think, does something like that in one of his earlier movies, and I did that at one point in. I can't remember exactly, but there are moments in Valley of Elah like that where, Paul wanted just sort of things to fall away, and of course the ending of Lions for Lambs. I can't say that we got small, but there is a moment, the penultimate moment in Lions for Lambs.
Yeah,
people hadn't seen it. I won't give it away, but there's a scene where what you're looking at visually is just tremendously loud. I mean, just like. Would be breaking your eardrums, and the sound just drifts away into nothingness, and the orchestra just is playing.
Yeah, that's a gorgeous moment.
Yeah, moments like that are priceless for a composer, especially when the director says, you know, that's what I'm thinking I'm going to do here. You say, oh boy, this is now it's all up to me.
Yeah.
And a little unnerving at first, but what a challenge and what an opportunity, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Excuse me, I have a question.
Sure.
Yeah, I just wanted to, you work with Alan Rudolph a lot. In the past, and I was just curious, what is it like to work with him?
Well, Alan was my first sort of, long-term relationship. My third film was an Alan Rudolph film, and he was just sort of getting on a roll. As a young director, he'd just come out of working a lot with Robert
Altman. That's one of my favorites on Trouble in Mind.
That was the first one that I did, yeah.
I love that film.
Oh, thank
Great
you.
Film.
Well, see, I'd gone to see Choose Me,
That's another one.
Which was, I think, his first breakout movie on his own.
Mm-hmm.
Not his first movie, but the first one that really...
The first one that got everyone's attention.
Exactly. And it got my attention. I came back and said to my agent, I saw this movie over the weekend. I want to work with this guy. And strangely enough, Alan had just turned a record of mine and had phoned his producer and said, does this guy write film score? So it was... And that's the way our relationship was for, I don't know, God, 10, 11 films I think we've done.
Mm.
Just very... We think alike. He is one of the most... improvisational film directors that I've ever worked with.
And I think it's always an event when a film of his, you know, comes out. I mean, he's a very unique director.
Yeah. And we just hit it off right from the beginning. You know, he'd be one of the ones that would be willing for me just to hire a band and then, you know, write a few tunes and then let them sort of improvise these tunes as a score. You know, he would love ideas like that.
Great.
Because he would do scenes like that. He would say, this is a scene I don't want to know exactly how this is going to go. I just want to tell the characters that this is what they got to come out of this room having achieved this and just let them do it. You know?
Yeah.
Cool.
And that's brave. Film
that is.
That is very, and it's harder and harder to do. In fact, I don't know if anybody can get away with it anymore. But, you know, it was a remarkable experience working with someone like that who's willing to think like that and willing to, you know, let you create a score like that.
Right.
Mr. Isham, we have a question for you from our chat room from a listener by the name of Neo.
Okay.
And first of all, he wants to make it clear he believes that you are a genius and he's very giddy just listening to you.
I think Neo's a she, actually.
I'm sorry. Neo says, and I hope I read this question correctly, have you considered collaborating with George Winston again?
Actually, that hasn't come up. No, I'm not quite sure where George is these days. I know that you know, he founded his record label and got very involved in that, and hadn't heard that he'd actually been playing much anymore. I could be completely wrong. I'm just sort of out of touch with George's life, and don't really know.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay, and Neo is a she. I'm so sorry. I've apologized to her on the chat room. Is there a community among film composers? Do you communicate often with each other or follow each other's work?
Well, I think we follow each other's work. I mean, I certainly know that I look at other film composers' work. I like to see because, you know, like any profession that's evolving. I mean, it is evolving, and there are trends and styles and things that are considered the way to do things for a while, and then all of a sudden it's, you know, oh, we don't do that anymore, you know.
Right.
But it's actually a pretty lonely profession in the sense that the real nuts and bolts work of it are done by yourself in a room, usually late at night, and the quieter the better. So we don't really get a chance to hang out with each other a lot because there's very, very seldom are there more than one composer on a film. And even if there are, you're probably writing by yourselves and then, you know, show and tell what you're showing and telling what you've done to each other.
Yeah.
I really enjoy it when I do have a chance. I remember the first time that I met Hans Zimmer. I said, well, we need to have lunch, and we managed to have two lunches, I think, in 10 years. But we really do enjoy it when we do. And I finally met Michael Dana and... Rolf Kent the other night, which was really a blast because it was great to meet them because they're very unique and wonderful composers.
I know that when we spoke to Howard Shore, he talked about he's going into opera. He's done an opera for The Fly, and I was wondering, is there something that you're dying to do, a dream that has not yet been fulfilled?
Well, I still my dreams are still in the trumpet playing side of the world and the performing side. I still find that having a band that is a close-knit band where we understand each other well musically and that we have the same sort of goals to create sort of a conversational, improvisational music in front of an audience. Because I've had these bands before.
Yeah.
And when they're at the top of their game and you on tour and doing a series of, you know, great venues playing music like this, there's really nothing else better as far as I'm concerned. But the sensation of putting yourself out there on this sort of creative tightrope, you know, not having it, you know, predetermined and exactly rehearsed down to the 16th note, knowing that you're going out to create this stuff totally fresh and virtually brand new, but that you trust the people that you're with and you're willing to go out in front of, you know, thousands of people and do this, and then pulling it off, there's really very little like that for me.
Yeah, there's nothing like the thrill of live performance. Yeah,
yeah. And so I still, you know, one of the reasons I'm a father now of four children, so film composing is a great, you know, creative outlet for me, and it's a nice job, and it keeps me home with my children. I think as the children grow up, I will probably try to, you know, shift the balance again of my career back to more performing, because,
mm-hmm.
and that's probably my dream.
Yeah,
I would have to say because, one of the things that I have experimented with is bringing film and the larger ensembles into that. I've done some evenings of with orchestras where we project film, and yet there's still this sort of improvisational core, and that's really exciting. So, although I can't really articulate a specific dream, it's probably along those lines to really work. And I can see why Howard, you know, get back into the concert hall, you know, get back into the live music. It's,
oh, yeah.
It's so vital and so much fun for everybody. The audience certainly has a great time.
Oh, yeah, it must be a thrill. Mr. Isham, you've been so nice to us, giving us so much time tonight. Can I accept one call for you, and then we'll wrap things up?
Certainly.
860 area code. Go right ahead.
Oh, my name is Tony Harrington. I've been following you for years. I'm surprised you haven't did a conceptual album like Vapor Drawing. There's a new side of you that's how I discovered you. Have you ever thought about doing something like that again?
It crosses my mind, yeah. I'm actually working on two albums right now. Whenever I manage to find a spare weekend or something from the film work.
It's hard with seven films that a year.
Yeah. It is very, very hard. And I have, you know, three sons in school that are playing sports, and there's games to go to. I mean,
oh, wow.
There's a lot to do here. But I still, I've expressed my love for live music, and part of being able to get out there and accept live concerts is having an album out there. It sort of creates the momentum for booking tours and concerts.
Mm-hmm.
So the albums are important. I can't say that a specific sort of new age record is in the offing. I am working on an album of jazz standards, but put into a very different settings, almost settings where you can't really tell what the original song was at first.
Huh.
And it sort of unfolds like a surprise package. And it is very electronic. Basically, at this point, it's just trumpet with electronics only. And then there's a few guest artists. You know, Sid Page comes and plays violin, and I've planned a few others. So I can't say it's stylistically New Age, but it is trumpet and electronics. It does have that similarity. And then there's an original composition album underway, too, that's a little more sort of acid jazzy remix, you know, a little more groove-oriented.
Oh, wow, can't wait. Yeah. When do those come out?
Well, really, you know, when I find the time. At this point, we're not going to make it this year. I wanted to try and at least get one of them out this year. It doesn't look like I'll... But I hope to get the albums done this year and both out next year for sure.
And on the film composing front, what do you have upcoming?
Currently, I'm working on a wonderful film, a Dennis Quaid film directed by Gary Flader, the story of Ernie Davis, the first black Heisman Trophy winner.
Hmm.
Well, that should be good.
Which I'm actually sort of constantly on the lookout for football movies because I have two sons who both play football, one at a very, very high level. So it's almost like a family thing. Oh, Dad can score a football movie, then it's involved, you know?
Well,
thus you see, you know, a fair number of football movies scattered over the last couple of years also.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we look forward to all of that. Mr. Isham, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
It's been a great pleasure to speak with you, and please come back to us anytime you want in the future.
Well, I very much enjoy that. It's been a great pleasure for me, too.